Welcome to the Religion Unplugged podcast. I'm Matthew Peterson. Each week we take a behind-the-scenes look at a topic in the news about the role of religion in public life to gather more insight and understanding on the stories being covered and the people who are covering them. Today on the podcast, Religion Unplugged's culture critic Joseph Holmes and designer and contributing writer Maria Rajan discuss the differences and similarities between Hindu nationalism and Christian nationalism. Let's listen in.
Hello, everyone. My name is Joseph Holmes, resident culture critic at Religion Unplugged. And with me today is my brilliant, passionate colleague, Maria. Maria, would you introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Maria, like how you just called me. I work from India, and I largely cover women, children, and social issues.
Fantastic. Yes, we're really excited to talk to each other today. Today we're going to be discussing Christian nationalism and Hindu nationalism, their similarities, differences, and why it matters. Partly actually how this came up is we were discussing this in one of our meetings. We were kind of doing roundup of our coverage. And we realized that we were seeing this gap in religious news coverage. There's a lot of coverage around Christian nationalism in America, obviously. And sometimes some little discussion of Hindu nationalism, if it comes up in the news, we've certainly covered it. But rarely a serious attempt to help people understand them in light of each other and global situations and all that. So I figured we just close that gap as the number one global religious news organization in the world, as determined by me just now. So ready to get started?
Yep.
Cool. So first you're going to kind of tackle Hindu nationalism, because that's the one that people at least in America probably know the least about. So what is Hindu nationalism? What makes it distinct from ordinary Hindu beliefs and practices?
So Hindu nationalism, often referred to as Hindutva, it is a political ideology that seeks to equate Indian cultures with Hindu values. It aggressively seeks the worldly interests of Hindus, projecting those interests to be in conflict with the religious minorities, especially the Muslims and the Christians. And it projects India's past glory before the invasion of the Muslim Mughals and the Christians' colonial powers, like the Great Britain. Although Hindus are in majority, it seeks to inculcate a sense of victimhood among the Hindus, which is quite interesting that I find. And it advocates for a revenge as a means to correct the perceived, you know, historical wrongs. It appears to be, to me, it's inspired by the European fascism, you know. And yeah. Hindutva is a it was codified in 1922. In a book which is called as What is a Hindu? And as per Hindu nationalism, India should be one nation, no race, no different races. It's just one nation, one race, and one culture.
Gotcha. Okay, so that's really interesting. And then we'll get into this as we talk about Christian nationalism as well. You can definitely, I think, for a lot of people, see different similarities going on there. But yeah, Hinduism is a religion in India that is the majority religion and has been. And the history of Hinduism, as I understand it, in India is really fascinating, because it was, you know, in many respects, Hinduism was just the religion and the diversity of religions that people practiced in India sort of prior to the Muslim invasions and prior to the colonialism, which, you know, partly, you know, brought Christianity. And it's interesting, so that the Hindu nationalism is taking a look at that narrative and saying, we want our identity in India to be Hinduism, our national identity and the religious Hindu identity to be the same thing. And looking back on the glory days of being like, okay, we once were this, we were once great. And what has kept us from being great the way we were is this imposition of foreign, you know, either Christianity or Islam or whatever else. And so in order to have our glory days and be who we truly are, we have to, as a country, as a political country, we have to have, get back to our religious identity in the same. So it is our religious identity, our political identity are the same thing. That would be an accurate way to describe that?
Yeah, so Hindu nationalism, it is, a fight or It is to protect and propagate the social and political domain of the Hindu community. Okay. And they are not promoting the religion, but they do promote not so favoritism towards other religious ideologies and other people from different religious beliefs. And like I said before, though they are in majority, they play this victim card, which is quite interesting to look at.
So what? And so what do they? Sorry. Go ahead.
No. You can continue.
So what specifically do they? First of all, what specifically do they cite as examples of what's causing their victimhood? And what are they doing to try to kind of enshrine favoritism for Hinduism in the country?
So, for instance, the Ghar Vapasi, which happened when Modi initially came to power, where they said that, all Indians are supposed to be and only Hindus, and having any other religious belief or having any other faith is not really favored. And the Ayodhya, where the Babri Masjid was initially, which was a mosque and it was demolished, and now the Ayodhya temple came to happening. So the whole journey of reclaiming the old glory and identifying and creating India to be this Hindu Rashtra.
So, gotcha. Okay. So like they've abolished, they've torn down and abolished old like mosques and such, and rebuilding them as Hindu temples is one example.
Yeah, it is one. And it is.
Okay. No, totally. The other, and what do they see as examples of, their victimhood? Again, because, like you said, it is difficult to make a case that you're the oppressed majority when you are the majority. But typically people are able to find narratives and examples of that. What do they cite? Is it just, because one thing, you made the connection to kind of fascism, European fascism, and what they would often say is, "Oh, look how poor we are!" Like in Nazi Germany, it was like, "Look how poor we are. That's the fault of the Jews who live here. So we have to get rid of the Jews, and then we'll be less poor." The Jews were the ones who were typically more well off in there. So like, okay, they're keeping us poor. So like, what is it that they cite as examples of how Hindus are quote unquote like oppressed or victims in their own country?
For instance, they talk about, saving a culture, the Indian culture, what they call it, where for instance, the eating of non-veg, like beef, is banned in most of the states in India. And then the interreligious marriages, where if Hindus are marrying people from other religious identities, they feel like, they're losing people from their community. And the whole preserving of culture is something where they constantly feel like, we as people of Hindustan are supposed to be like this.
So what they see is that they're dwindling, even if they are a majority, they're dwindling as a culture and their cultural influence is dwindling. So the numbers of Hindus are going down and their influence is going down. So they're, the fact that more people are eating meat, than they used to, or beef and such like that. And more people are intermarrying, religions are marrying. So there's that fewer Hindus. And so they're like, okay, well, the way to solve this problem.
So, in 1920s, when in India that independence became to look as a possibility, there was always the India's grand old party, Indian National Congress, which was leading the independence movement. But at the same time, the Hindu National, right now what it is called as BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, back in the days was called as Hindu Mahasabha. When it came close to independence, there was definitely an attempt by them and by everybody in an understanding of how can we bring these different princely states, which has now come together as one unit and are trying to fight and get independence and stay as one unit. So though at that time, Hindu Mahasabha did try an approach of solidifying and, you know, bringing everyone together on the basis of the religious and the Hindutva movement, it didn't really work out. But because everyone was trying to just stay together. So the international congresses, attempt to put do not to bring in the religious identity as the main factor to put to get people together, but let's we all have a common enemy, let's get them out and stay and have an independent movement is what happened, and that worked.
And yeah, okay, no, so that's really interesting because there is this history of India was its own country, and then even when it was the Muslims came in and took it over, then it became a British colony. And once it was a British colony, then once there was the idea of it being an independent state, there was going to be like, okay, well, who are we? You know, if we're not independent, what's our identity that's separate from being a British colony and separate from being a kind of a Muslim occupied? What are we if we're not that? So we can have something to come around. And that's something you see a lot kind of nowadays is with all the diversity, you know, in America, it's like, okay, well, what unites us and how do we have a common, you know, a common identity and common culture that we can hold us together? Those are really interesting conversations. That's interesting. It's happening everywhere. So when it comes to, so moving over here to Christian nationalism, there's similar things going on, but there is, of course, also, you know, it's interesting you have the book, What is a Hindu? Because, you know, what is Christian nationalism is a question that's similarly very difficult to define. It's almost kind of like a Rorschach test. When I look at kind of journalism around Christian nationalism, it's kind of like a Rorschach test to how to define it, depending on whoever's using it. So like, you know, the statement on Christian nationalism by many of the movement's most ardent founders and defenders, like William Wolfe, like defines Christian nationalism as a set of governing principles rooted in scriptures teaching that Christ rules as supreme Lord and King over all creation, who has ordained civil magistrates with delegated authority under him over the people in order to their ordained jurisdiction by punishing evil and promoting good for his glory, etc. In the movie God and Country, which was like Rob Reiner produced documentary about the rise of Christian nationalism, sometimes they say there's a distinction between Christian nationalists and ordinary conservative Christians in America who believe in opposition to abortion or want smaller government. And other times they claim that anyone who opposes things like abortion is a Christian nationalist and trace the origins of Christian nationalism to the birth of the religious right. So things like the Time Magazine piece, The Roots of Christian Nationalism, and Newsweek's What is Christian Nationalism? Similarly, basically say that Christian nationalists, it's similar to kind of how you described anyone who says America was founded as a Christian nation and should reflect Christian values is we define a Christian nationalist. That said, a lot of people generally agree to place the emergence of Christian nationalism as a phrase to describe people on the Christian right and to the American lexicon, to the January 6th insurrection attempt that was on January 6th of after the election, the American election in 2020. So, you know, I think that a lot of the better way to kind of talk about Christian nationalism is to describe how it's different from the normal Christian right in the country, you know, what changed in conservative Christianity, the Christian right in the country, post kind of that caused us to use a new phrase to differentiate it, you know, what changed was that while conservative Christians typically believe that every law in the country should reflect Christian values, or at least Judeo-Christian values, that government that reflects Christian values should be as small as possible and should pass as few laws as possible. Whereas Christian nationalists believe that such a government based on Christian values should be as big as possible and pass as many laws as possible. So conservative Christianity is small government Christian nationalism, you could say, and Christian nationalism is big governments, Christian nationalism. What's interesting is this rift. What'd you say?
So,
yeah, go ahead.
Out is, do they want a separation between the church and the state? Or they want it to be one?
So Christian nationalists, I guess what you'd say, would see there's no separation between church and state, whereas the religious right typically believes in some separation of church and state as defined by, I mean, so what, the reason I call it small government versus big government is because, you know, on the Christian right, there's an idea that, you know, there's no separation between church and state in the sense that Christian values should be respected. It should be influencing the government. So, like, you know, again, people on the conservative Christianity would say abortion should be illegal because we believe that it is life begins at conception, and that is partly, and murder is wrong. But the belief that life is at conception is partly influenced by our Christian faith. So that is something that where my Christian faith should be reflected in the laws. But something like everybody needs to get baptized in my church should not be reflected in the laws, because as Rachel Ferguson, who's a classical liberal scholar, she was like, you know, one is natural law and the other is divine revelation. So things that fall under natural law should be enshrined into law, and others, and things that are part of divine revelation should not be part of law. So that's how religious right. And then Christian nationalists are like, basically everything should be reflected into law. Basically, yeah, there's no, so Christian religious right says, here's where it's the line, there's a governing principle for here's where law should be passed and here's where law should not be passed. Whereas the Christian nationalists say, they don't have a governing principle for like what laws should not be passed. One of the interesting places of controversy was, like, for example, I'm on Christian Twitter a lot. One of the funny, sort of not so funny, but arguments broke out was when there was like a Satan statue in I forget which state it was. And there was one guy who came in and basically smashed that statue. And the reason the statue was there was like every religious group gets to, you know, put up something for a week, you know, and so he smashed it. And the Christian right was like, okay, this is not good to be lawlessly, you know, decide we have to, everybody has to be equal under the law. All religions do. Even if I don't like it, we have to obey the law that every, and Christian nationalists were like, no, some things should have privileges and others should not, because some are good and some are bad. And, you know, the Christian religious right was kind of like, well, okay, but how does that create a line so that we don't go back to Protestants and Catholics, you know, at each other's throats again, like we're in the history? So the where this kind of movement on the religious right happened, and where it was, the rift first became kind of widely started was back at kind of in 2019, oddly enough, when we're doing a debate between conservative commentators David French and Sohrab Ahmari, who then penned a piece against David Frenchism. What?
I'm saying, so it's a new thing that has just...
Yeah, so it's in... For a while, again, the Christian nationalism is a fairly new thing in Christian development insofar as it's distinct from the typical Christian right. Because again, the typical Christian right in America is small government. It's based on small government. It's based on let's impose some values on everybody else, the very bare minimum, and then leave everybody to have freedom. That. As a cultural practice, we're going to try to win the culture for Christ, but not using it, imposing laws. The idea that we should use laws to impose Christian values is fairly new. Yeah, like 2019. I mean, it's fairly new in the sense for the last 100 years. And the Christian right. And the idea was basically that conservative Christians have failed to preserve Christian culture with their small government ideas. That, you know, again, since the conservative Christians have kind of been running the Christian right, you know, we've had, you know, the sexual revolution, we've had gay marriage, we've had transgenderism, we've had kind of the rise of the, basically the erosion of people at Christian values, like you were talking about Hindu nationalism. And so it's like, okay, because the Christian right has failed, the reason they failed is because they haven't been using the government and laws in order to entrench those Christian values. And so that's where that came from. Now, and that's what I would say the rise and the growth of Christian nationalism as a sort of separatistic movement has come in the American context.
Yeah, now, so like similar in the Hindu situation where that, you know, in the early 20th century, this thing started, but it only resurged later on in 1990s when the International Congress, the Indian Grand Old Party, was having a shift in power, and there was a, you know, some kind of a political vacuum which was happening when that's when they re-emerged quite violently, in fact. Sorry, continue.
No. So I think this is an interesting discussion, because it seems that for both of these movements, the genesis of them is, and you can add to this what you see is that in a sense in which the cultural consensus around these values, either whether it's sort of traditional Hindu values or it's traditional Christian values, is eroding within those countries, or there is perceived erosion of them. And no, there is go ahead. Yeah.
No, in Hindu nationalism, I feel like they're trying to get that attention and get the mass to follow their footsteps by depicting those things. Because, Savarkar, who wrote and codified Hindu nationalism, in that he, in fact, did not mention about religion. He was only talking about the worldly interests of Hindus.
Okay. You know,
and the values of Hindu nationalism is actually, in fact, like I said before, it is about the social and the political dominion of the Hindu communities.
Gotcha. So you say that... you would say in sort of with Hindu nationalism, it's really at its core a power grab, and using the idea, the fears of your culture is fading away and being taken away as a way to solidify that power.
Yep.
Yeah. Yes. But would you say that the reason that it's having some success with people is because of that feeling that the traditional Hindu values are eroding?
For Christians, we are monotheistic. We have one God, we have one set of belief systems, but for Hindus, they're not like that. They have hundreds of gods and hundreds of different stories and hundreds of different practices. But for one group to come and say that we are one, and we need to unite, brought in certain sense of community.
Gotcha. Okay. So really, again, it's as I understand what you're saying, they're really in other places in the world. Again, I'm in the American Christian context. I can't speak to other religious contexts, but in other contexts like America, there really is something that you could say was a Christian kind of consensus of Christian Western values that existed, that you can say is kind of being lost. But in the Indian context, trying to impose a monolithic Hindu culture is really a new thing that is kind of being invented by Christian nationalism and trying to unite people, because really you're taking a diverse diverse Hindu kind of community and trying to actually bring them together and say, we are all one thing, and kind of lying and saying we used to be one thing and they took it away, when really there was no one thing that we'd had.
There's one thing, you know. So in 1990s, when I said that, you know, this thing researched, what was happening is in Indian National Congress, there was, the Rajiv Gandhi, son of Indira Gandhi, passed away. And his wife, Sonia Gandhi, who's an Italian by origin and a Christian, she became the head of the party. And that's when this resurgence became, you know, it became much more bigger, where there was a talking about how, you know, how can a Christian woman, a foreigner, lead the country now and lead the biggest party, which until then was the biggest party.
So that's fascinating. So, because again, it's true, you know, many people, again, you know, this is me, when I was studying religions in college and world religions, one of the things that comparison they made between sort of Hinduism they would make and Shintoism sort of in Japan, in the sense that it wasn't exactly, strictly speaking, a religion. It was simply the diversity of views that everybody within this, you know, islands, this country believed. And it was sort of this unified religion was a, in a sense, a creation of interaction with other, you know, groups that believe differently. Like first, you know, so in Hinduism, it was due to an interaction with the Muslims who are like, okay, we believe this. So everything you guys believe, we're going to put over here as under this. And then you have the Christians who are like, okay, we believe this and the Muslims believe this. So you guys are here. And so this attempt to kind of create a kind of Hindu identity in the modern world is, again, sort of a political thing where it's like, we don't like that people who are distinct from us, kind of a distinct culture, a distinct identity, are gaining power in a way that's different from our culture. And so we have to create an identity that's both religious and political in order to stand against them politically, which in that case, kind of the similar narratives are in kind of the US and in the Arab world about distinctions of, you know, whether it's kind of the Christian Western culture that's kind of, you know, in it being interacting with these other cultures. Or again, in America, it's kind of like secular liberalism, where it's, again, the high roads of promiscuity, whether it's feminism, whether it's, you know, whether it's gay marriage, sexual orientation, gender identities, or whether it's in some cases, this is, I think, a minority of this, and we'll get to this a little bit later, but whether it's race, you know, these ideas that there is, we had a culture and there are certain things about the culture we liked, and these are being eroded, is the narrative within the West as well. That, and Christian nationalism, distinctly because of our distinct history, is we tried the liberal democratic way, which is to do this purely by persuasion, to hold our culture together purely by cultural means. That didn't work. So now we have to use it by government means. That's sort of, you know, something that's in the American narrative, and in other places though, but what unifies it is basically we need to have the government to impose some of this religious and social order, that we've lost, is an interesting kind of unifying thing in these kind of global narratives.
Yeah, that's true. And to me, very interestingly, one thing that we see is they do not openly preach Hindu religion, but they do instigate violence against other communities.
One of the big reasons that people are, you know, afraid of, you know, Christian nationalism is the fear of persecution by, you know, of other groups, by Christian groups, either, you know, that and that they are encouraging violence. Again, you know, the Christian nationalists were overrepresented in the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Now, and, you know, President Donald Trump, who's often kind of seen as the president of the Christian nationalists and person, he, you know, explicitly called on people to protest there. Now, discouraging of the violence, and people would say, and he encouraged the idea that the election was stolen. So people were like, okay, he encouraged this. And people were like, well, no, he didn't encourage the violence. He encouraged conspiracy theories, which led to violence. And so there is this kind of question about, like, are these groups encouraging violence against these other groups? And that's a controversial element, but in India, it's like, no, they're explicitly calling for violence of these groups.
Yeah. So in fact, when I was reading for this podcast, if you look at just attack and against Christian, the last year alone, it was 600 cases. 600 cases until now, till this is March. We're in March, right? March. There is almost 160 cases of attack against Christians in India. And this is by a forum called as United Christian Forum, which is a Delhi-based organization. And they themselves, as an independent organization, have found so many cases. So we cannot say that, there is no attack towards minorities, which is violent physical attack. And that is one of the biggest reasons why people are concerned for their own safety. People are concerned about their fundamental rights. And
Cool.
so
So,
it is a scary situation to live in, but it's also a very historic moment to be alive in India.
yes, that's true. So I guess so. Well, we're wrapping up soon, but I want to kind of close us out, kind of with a couple of questions. So one is, So I guess, how should people, in order to be informed on these issues, kind of look at the coverage that they're receiving and make sure that they're getting kind of the best to kind of accurate information on this topic? And what is, if people are concerned about things like Hindu nationalism, what are the best kind of paths forward that you can kind of see in this situation, who has kind of answers and kind of political attempts to kind of or and to kind of move a path forward. So yeah, what do you see as kind of the plausible path forward, and what are the best ways to get information about this that you found?
So we need to also understand that, research is very important. Just reading news articles, especially which are coming out of India, because most of the media houses here are all bought, and the information that you get is always biased. So one thing that if you want to understand, study Hindu nationalism, is research by yourself, understand how structured they are.
Do you see some kind of hope on the horizon about Hindu nationalism in your country? Or does that seem to be the movement just seem to be growing, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of stopping it?
It is growing, and I think this Lok Sabha also they will win. I think maybe after that, maybe the next one. Let's see. Let's see.
So on mine and Christian nationalism, I think, there's a similar, kind of like look at the left and right wings of stuff and see, see how that is. It is interesting because the right wing on our side is fractured right now between Christian nationalists and conservative Christians. And so, for me, when looking at coverage, I would say to people to look at, just look at when people are saying Christian nationalism, how are they defining it? Because they will, some people use Christian nationalism to mean the Christian right, and then anyone who's a Christian right. And some people are using it to refer specifically to those on the Christian right that want to unify church and state in a very specific way. So, big government Christian right, so to speak. And so just know, it doesn't matter. You can have whatever view of it you want, but just know what version of that they're talking about. Another aspect of this is that sometimes they will conflate Christian nationalism with white ethnocentric Christian nationalism, which is difficult to do. It's problematic because, as sociologist George Yancey pointed out, he's a Black Christian sociologist who pointed this out as a Pew review study, a Pew research study, was that American Hispanic Protestants have a higher rate of support for Christian nationalism than white evangelicals do, and Black, Protestants are not far behind whites. And so, are people talking about white ethnocentric Christian nationalism? Are they talking about Christian nationalism in general, which is sort of a multi-ethnic thing? So again, find out what people are talking about. I will say, sort of in the optimism side for America, in generally, like Ryan Burge has talked about this, and George Yancey has probably talked about this. In general, support for Christian nationalist ideas are going down in the country. The vast majority of white evangelicals don't have a positive view of Christian nationalism. So while the people who are proponents are growing louder and solidifying as their own kind of community, in general, support for these things are going down. So I think in terms of optimism for people who are afraid of Christian nationalism, I think in America, you know, it's more smoke than a lot of people are wanting to say it is. But that doesn't mean that I think the place for concern is in terms of a conflation of ideas where people are like, what are we talking about when we're talking about Christian nationalism? The confusion is rising and the disillusion of the Christian right, where it's like, maybe liberal democracy doesn't work. Like maybe freedom doesn't work, I think is a long-term issue that should be dealt with in a conversation to have. And I would say those on the Christian right who believe in kind of more freedom along with Christian values need to start making a better case as to why, you know, as to why that still matters and why the reason we've been losing, quote unquote, if we isn't because we haven't used the government to force people. I think that that's a conversation. But I think, again, there's reason for optimism here. I think for, it sounds like in terms of Hindu nationalism, the situation in India, prayers are one thing that we need to be doing, as well as educating ourselves on this. And of course, reading a lot of articles on the topic from Religion Unplugged, because we are, in a totally unbiased way, I would say we're doing a lot of good coverage, partly due to people like Maria. So anyway, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. And thank you. Please continue to support us at Religion Unplugged, which is your one-stop shop for the best religious news and culture coverage.
Thank you, Joseph and Maria. You can find more of their work on religionunplugged.com. Thank you for listening to the Religion Unplugged podcast. All of our reporting is made possible and paid for directly by donors like you. In fact, we want to thank everyone who gave to Religion Unplugged at the end of the year as part of our News Match campaign from the Institute of Nonprofit News. Thanks to you, we were able to match funds and raise more than $28,000 for editorial needs to pair contributors for religion stories from around the globe that might otherwise go untold. Consider how you can join us year-round in our effort to increase religious literacy. Whether that's a small donation, signing up for our weekly newsletter, following us on X, Instagram, and Facebook, or sharing our work on your social media channels, we look forward to partnering with you.